Shalom, today, the 17th day of the month of Menachem Av of the year 5776, corresponding to the 21st of August of the year 2016. And today we are continuing with our study of the Bible commentaries on the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel, which is perhaps one of the most significant of all of the visions for giving us an overall view of the Daniel's perception of the end of days. And this has ramifications for ourselves today in order to understand our situation. And since we have already in the previous sessions looked at some comments on chapter 7 by the major classical biblical commentators, I would today like to turn to the commentary of one of the outstanding latter-day rabbinical commentators on the Tanakh, and that is the commentator whose commentary is known by the name of Malbim. Malbim is an acrostic of the name of Rabbi Meir Leibush ben Yechiel Michiel Wisse, who was born in the year 1809 and passed away in 1879. He was born in Ukraine and he died in Ukraine, but in the course of his life as a rabbi, his career took him to the city of Bucharest, where he was chief rabbi at a time when the Reform Jewish movement was gaining rapid ground, including among many of the wealthy sectors of the Jewish populations in those countries of Middle and Eastern Europe. And Rabbi Meir Leibush, the Malbim, was in no mood to compromise with those who were demanding changes to the Orthodox liturgy, changes, modifications, and leniences in the practice of Torah. And he was actually obliged to leave Bucharest and leave his post as chief rabbi. He went back to Ukraine, but he was also asked to leave another city. He was measures were taken to have him removed from another city where he was, again, because of opposition from certain sectors of the Jewish communities. And he ended his days in Kiev. And he left us a priceless heritage of his extremely subtle explanation of our Hebrew text, with the most beautiful analysis of the fine nuances of the Hebrew through his outstanding scholarship, both of the Hebrew language and the entire Tanakh and Talmud and other biblical writings, but also through his very extensive knowledge of general history and other subjects. Well, in order to put a perspective on his commentaries on chapter 7, we have to start with his commentary actually on Daniel chapter 2, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, because all of the visions of Daniel do link together. Indeed, the entire Torah is one unity, and each different part of the Torah throws light on all other parts of the Torah. Verbal nuances in one place relate to our comprehension of a similar text in some other place. And so the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, of the great statue that stretched all the way upwards with the head of gold and the arms and torso of silver, the lower chest and of bronze, and the legs of iron, and the feet with the toes of iron and clay. Malbim tells us about this, that in his commentary on chapter 2, that this is indeed a key to the understanding of the later visions in the book. And he has no doubts in his commentary on Daniel chapter 2 that the last section of the statue, the lowest section, which is the legs of iron and the feet of clay and iron, this is associated with Rome. And we shall see in a moment that his comprehension of what Rome is much wider than what we today might think of historically as the Roman Empire. But let's put that aside for a moment. He says that the kingdom of Rome did not arise suddenly, but it started off serving as one of the of a power together with the remaining power of Greece. And each of them was a most powerful empire. And that is why the thighs and the limbs, both of which relate to the legs. The one is the upper thigh. The thighs are of bronze and the lower shins are of iron, because they were adjacent to one another in their these empires. Historically, they were next to one another. And we see that Daniel does not refer to any other power arising after this fourth power, which Malbim, like all of our other commentators, associates with the Empire of Rome. And the concept of the iron of the legs is, says Malbim, points to the great power of the Romans, who were powerful as iron in two respects. Iron has the power to grind up and slice off everything, and even things that iron is not capable of breaking directly, it has the power to grind them up for its own purpose. And the second thing is that iron, when it destroys something, it breaks, smashes something, it smashes something entirely. And in this way, the fourth empire was going to smash entirely some of the other nations. And some of them, however, would get pieced, joined together again, and but they were going to be subject to the kingdom of Rome, the empire of Rome. And he continues by saying that this kingship, this empire of the Romans, started off with the shins being described as being of iron, as being entirely strong like iron. But Malbim points out that this empire has two legs, the two shins, because it was divided into two kingdoms. And here he says it out directly, Yishmael and Edom, both of whom were like iron. In other words, Malbim accepts the prevailing view of the previous classical commentators that the fourth empire is a joining of Rome and of Ishmael, and we shall see in his commentary on chapter 7 how this plays out in practice. Well, he will go into details of the history of both Edom and Ishmael. And he says, from the time of their, as they developed together, it turned into a divided empire, he says, and it was always, there were always inherent divisions in this empire, because one of the, one aspect is that of the iron in the feet, and the other is the aspect of the clay in the field, in the feet. And he says that is because at different times, one will get stronger, the other will get weaker. And that's why he does not say which particular leg is of iron and which is of clay, because at times one plays that role, at times the other one plays that role. Well, having established in this commentary on Nebuchadnezzar's dream the identity of the fourth kingdom, let us now turn to Malbim's extensive commentary on the vision of Daniel, which took place, as we've mentioned several times, in the beginning of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar's younger son, Belshazzar, who was to be deposed and killed imminently. And I'm going to make only some selections from the commentary of Malbim, which is very extensive, and I am not aware of a full translation of Malbim's commentary into English. And I am sitting here with my Tanakh and actually translating Malbim's commentary as we go along. So it is a great treasure that we have printed in our contemporary text of the Hebrew. Now, he starts at the beginning of his commentary on chapter 7 when talking about these monsters, these chivin, which is the Aramaic equivalent of the chayot. He says that these four empires that took over the power over the world one after the other, they are standing in the four directions of the divine Merkava. They are parallel to the chayot that were the chayot, the vital essences that were seen in Ezekiel in his vision of the chariot, the Merkava, in Ezekiel chapter 1. Only the Arba Malchuyot, the four kingdoms, are on a lower level. They are not on the exalted spiritual level in which Ezekiel perceived them, but they've come down level by level from the spiritual worlds of the Chayot. They're deriving their nourishment from the Chayot, but they're actually embodied in our lowly physical world. And he saw them as they were acting in our physical world and not in the way that Ezekiel had perceived the Chayot, the vital angelic essences. And we've already he discusses how the head is Babylon and the arms and upper torso are Persia, and then comes the Greeks, as we've seen. Now, he mentions how Babylon was disabled in the vision of Daniel chapter 7, that the lion that comes forth, which is obviously related to the lion face of the Chayot seen by Ezekiel, he says it was cut down to size, and that's why our text says that it was stood on its feet. Originally, Babylon had these wings that enabled Babylon to extremely swiftly fly all over the world, but later on it was cut down to size, and he was given a heart of a man. In other words, they turned into relative weaklings, and all of their power and strength was put down in face of the coming animals. He speaks about the second beast that takes the appearance of the bear, and like our other commentators, he tells us that the bear is not as powerful as the lion, and likewise, the empire of Persia with Medea was not a global empire in the way that Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had. Although we do see at the beginning of the scroll of Esther that Nebuchadnezzar, Ahasuerus of Persia did rule over 127 provinces from Hodu v'ad Kush, from India to Africa. But the Persian and Median Empire are only silver in relation to Nebuchadnezzar's golden head. And we see that although it started off as a twin empire, alluded to in our text, is how the bear goes to one side. Only when it's on one side is it able to stand up, and that is when Darius of Media died, and his son-in-law took over. His son-in-law Cyrus, Koresh, followed by Ahasuerus and Darius II, they were on one side of this previously great double empire. And he speaks about the three ribs in the mouth between the teeth, and how they are how they're holding on to their vital assets. But I'd like to move on to the past his explanation of the third empire, that of Greece, I'd like to move forward to what is of most interest to us at the end of days, the fourth beast. He says in his commentary here on verse 7 of chapter 7, this fourth beast, this is representing the Empire of Rome, as Rashi and also the medieval commentator Ramban, also the medieval legalist and outstanding philosopher and scientist, the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, in all of their, in his letters, the letters of Rambam, such as the letter of the epistle of to the Jews of Yemen, all have agreed that this is Rome. And he tells us that the fear for the several words that describe this empire of Dechilo, Emosoni, Vatakifo, Yesero, it's three main descriptions of the fearsome, terrifying, and exceptionally powerful empire. Mambam here quotes Rabbi Yitzchok Abravanel, who was in the time of the Golden Age of Spain, and towards the time of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. He says that the reason for this threefold description is because the power of Rome and its government depended upon three things. First of all, a great cruelty, which was designed to strike fear into the heart of the nation so they should not rebel. And that's why it uses the first expression, emosoni, fearful. The second was that they used tremendous military brute force in order to overcome their enemies. And of that, it says that they were takifo yesero, exceptionally powerful. And these attributes were found in the other beasts that Daniel saw, but in the case of Rome, all of these attributes were exceptionally powerful. Now, as to the teeth that are of mighty teeth of iron, he says that the teeth grind up the food very finely. And that is how the teeth are able to bring the food down into the body and the nutrients turn into the creature that is being sustained by them. And this is how the vision gives us a mashal, a parable of the custom and power of the Romans to turn the Roman Empire over all. To turn the nations they conquered under them into one body with the Empire of Rome. We see this in the way that the Romans, as known to us from the Western Roman Empire, would capture Gaul, Germany, and Britain, and other provinces, and turn them into integrate them into Rome. We also see, given that we are seeing this fourth empire as also composite with Ishmael, we also see the dream and the vision of the Islamic caliphate, the Ummah, which is supposedly integrating all of the peoples that were brought under it. So this links up with Malbim's words over here, and he emphasizes that the description of the fourth beast trampling everything underfoot shows that it is not similar in any respect to the previous beasts. Because the previous beasts, even though they were each one different from the other in their form, there was a certain similarity in certain respects between the three of them. But this one, this fourth beast representing the fourth exile, the fourth empire, is different from the others in every respect. In other words, we see that its difference, says Malbim, both in the practice of its government as an empire, in its very great might, and also in the very great length of its days of endurance. In other words, the Fourth Empire lasts far, far longer than the 70 years of Babylon or the few decades of Persia and the couple of hundred years of Greece. And he says, even after the other nations were integrated into Rome and they verged into different kinds of beliefs and religions from the official from the beliefs of the previous empires, he says, were sheer pagans. He uses the expression of dei avodat elilim, the servants of worshipping elilim, which is empty gods, which refers to paganism. But the Fourth Empire is different also in that respect. And so the angel says to Daniel later on, this fourth beast will be in the earth, different from all of the other empires. Well, now we're going to come to some extremely interesting sections of this commentary. He says about the 10 horns of this fourth beast. In my opinion, he said, these 10 horns themselves correspond to the 10 toes of the feet that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. And he reminds us that he wrote over there that at the end of days, the kingdom of Rome, again looking at Rome in this expanded form of a composite of Edom and Ishmael, will incorporate into itself 10 great kingdoms or 10 great states, which will rule over the entire world and over all of the four directions. I think this commentary of Malbin is particularly interesting in our time when we do see that there are, for example, the G7, which is supposedly the seven major industrial nations. There are other groupings of nations. We see increasingly a trend towards more and more globalism in government. And this very much corresponds to Malbim's words of how the entire empire is actually dividing up into a variety of entities that make it up, but they're all initially they were all part of one empire. Afterwards, it split into two, and in the end, it split into 10 kingdoms, and all of the other kingdoms or states were all secondary to these 10. And likewise, he just casts back to the four heads of the Greek Empire, which stood after the days of Alexander. There was initially only one head, but after Alexander's death, the kingdom split up according to Malbim here, he says that actually the Alexander divided his empire into 12 governors, but at the end they ended up as being four main heads, as we've already discussed previously. And similarly, he says he saw Rome in this vision with its 10 horns that would arise at the end, relating to the 10 toes of the statue seen by Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 8 of chapter 7, Daniel is telling us how he is looking at these horns, and there, verse 8, he says, behold, another little horn gets up between them. So Rav Yitzchak Abravanel, the Spanish commentator of the late Middle Ages, wrote, quoted here by Malbim, that he was alluding to the empire or the rule of the Pope. And he says that this began in Rome, which in Rome's origin, it was small, and indeed even until the time of the end of Julius Caesar, the Caesars, the emperors that ruled over Rome, were relatively small. And he says here that this would include how also be included in the concept of the ten horns, which were there before the little one stepped up. We saw already how Rashi in his commentary related these ten horns to the ten Roman emperors before Titus and Vespasian, who destroyed the second temple. He says that, now this is what follows is very interesting. Before I get on to this Rambam, let me just make a point that will become important later in Malbim's discussion in this chapter, that the single most, from the point of view of Jewish history, the history of Israel, the single most significant act that was taken by Rome was the destruction of the Second Temple. And it was only this destruction of the autonomy of Judea that enabled Rome, as it developed, to develop a replacement theology that God had somehow displaced Israel and taken on the church as the replacement. Well, now some of my friends have expressed concern in my teaching about Daniel whether I would be saying that the tenth little horn was actually the founder of Christianity, and Malbim is quite clear that that is not the case. What he has to say now is extremely interesting. He says that after these ten horns, namely the first less powerful emperors, there gained strength this horn in the days of the Emperor Constantine, who took Pope Sylvester, I'm reading from Malbim here, who took Pope Sylvester, who had been hidden away in a cave, and he brought him to Rome, and he put the imperial crown in his hand, and this Pope and those who followed him in Rome would rule over Rome and Italy. And Constantine the Emperor went off to Constantina, namely to modern Istanbul, and there he built that city and made it the center of the subsequent Roman emperors. So here I think there's something very important that Malbim is telling us, that what is significant is not necessarily the original individual to whom the religion was attributed, but rather to the perverse distortions that were introduced by later figures. And here we are well familiar with the actions of Constantine in beginning the major major establishment of the replacement theology that was to lead to a far more bitter exile of the Jews in the subsequent centuries. So now what follows again is also most interesting. He says three of the horns were uprooted from before this little new horn. And Malbim writes here, all of the previous commentators have been very confused by this part of the vision. And he says that again, Rav Yitzchak Abravanel explains this according to his own approach to this whole chapter. He says, now I'll tell you what Malbim's opinion is. These three horns are the kings that were destined to take the horn of kingship, the general horn of kingship of Rome. And they were going to throw off the yoke of the rule of the Pope from upon them. And if you will look for them, you'll find there were three mighty wise kings who had very deep understanding, who separated from the empire of the Pope before several hundred years. And this is what is alluded to in the uprooting of these horns from the kingdom. So that's Malbim's first take on this. I think we could perhaps consider this in the light of the split of the church into the Roman and the Byzantine sectors, and afterwards we can look at it in the light of the what happened in the Reformation, the breakaway of the Anglican Church from Rome, and so on. Then he takes us to another fascinating thing. He says, on the other hand, if you also take into account the empire of Ishmael, which is included in the kingdom, the general kingdom of Rome, and I have seen discussions about how, in fact, the Ishmaelite religion was planted by priests from Rome. This itself is a story that well deserves investigation. So if this refers, going back to Malbim's words, to Ishmael, we see how different sections of the Ishmaelites broke off and separated into different views and different aspects of faith. And here he says what this faith is. This starts off as the Das Muhammad, the religion of Muhammad, and two other breakaway movements who made certain modifications to his religion. Well, I'm not familiar enough with the detailed history of the Ishmaelites and their religions. We do certainly see today the major difference between the Sunnis and the Shiite Muslims, and there are other groups as well. And he says that all of these different groups into which the Ishmaelite world broke are all uprooted from the small horn, and they all are in opposition to the both the religious and the political leadership of the smaller horn. We do see today how, for example, there is obviously a deep divide between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia priding itself on being the very guardian, as it were, of the Islamic tradition, but the Iranians feeling they have no less of a valid tradition. So in the explanation of the angel, the angel later relates how these three sections will fall off, divide off from the rule of the little horn, and he says that then this empire would cast down three kings, because he says there is a time when they will be uprooted from him, and after this they will fall from the little horn's power completely and get separated from being under him forever. And therefore he's going to, the root Ishmaelic empire is going to fight against these breakaway groups. He says also that there is room to interpret the little horn as referring to Muhammad himself, who came forth several hundred years after this, and this would be the small horn that is presenting his faith and his religion before the children of Ishmael. And he too, says Malbim, was small when he started, and after that he became very mighty and conquered Asia and other parts of the world. And this would explain in another way what the vision says about the three of the first horns being uprooted from before him. Namely, there will be three kingdoms that would that ruled originally out of the four heads of the kings of Greece that ruled after Alexander. These would be uprooted from before him, and they would come under the rule of Ishmael. And it could be that these two are, namely the viewing this empire as breaking up, partly from the point of view of Rome and the Western Rome, and partly from the point of view of Ishmael and the Eastern Empire. We can view this as two different aspects that are alluded to by the same symbols in the vision. And he says how Daniel was watching in verse 8. He sees how there are eyes like the eyes of a man on this horn. He saw that the little horn was not like the other horns, which had no mouth or eyes. And the normal strength of a horn lie in its ability to gore, to attack physically. But he says here it's very significant that the little horn has mouth and eyes, because this is the power of this empire. The eyes allude to intelligence and wisdom, because this last empire would use great wisdom and intelligence in all of their endeavors. And he says they would also look into the books of the Torah and the books of the prophets, and they would apply all kinds of sophistication to their interpretation of the holy writings. And here we see Malbim alluding to the replacement theology that's been practiced both by the Edomites and by the Ishmaelites, trying to use the very Israelite writings of the Torah to justify the replacement theology. And here Malbim now discusses the mouth that was speaking mighty grandiloquent things. He says this: the power of this empire would be in its mouth. In that they would be, they would have both have great understanding of the power of speech and how to use it. And in other words, he says that the power of the horn was not so much alluding to the sword in war, so much as the skill of the mouth, with which the Ishmaelite prophet was able to overcome his enemies and was able to knot things up and untie them all through the spirit of his lips, the air passing through his lips. And this is how they did war in the early days with other mighty kings. He was able to subdue them because they simply submitted to him because of his power of speech. They begged him for forgiveness. And he's alluding here, says Malbim, to historical texts which speak about this, the great power of their prophet with speech to make victories. Indeed, we do see that the writings of the Ishmaelites are extremely voluminous compared to, for example, the writings of the Christian Church, which are far more concise, and the actual number of sayings that is attributed to the founder of Christianity is much less than all that is written of written of the sayings and teachings of Muhammad. And we see that these have had in themselves a phenomenal influence over the world that was conquered by Islam. And until today, we see that people are being persuaded by what they're reading in these writings. So now he comes and Malbim comes to continue to the point in the vision in section 9, in verse 9 of chapter 7, when the thrones of judgment are set down. And here Malbim tells us that these thrones refer to the thrones of the pagan idolaters that the Holy One, blessed be He, is going to overturn. And here Malbim points out that it does not say until the thrones are set down to sit upon, but rather will be cast down. The Aramaic term is urmiu, which is a term relating to throwing something down, like God cast the Egyptians into the Red Sea. Sus v'roichavoy romo bayom. He threw down the horse and its rider into the sea. So he says that Daniel here was seeing the overthrow of the empires in the very process of judgment. He says that their overthrow would be... I'm looking at this and translating as I go along, so you'll forgive me if I sometimes take a moment to look at the Hebrew text before I say it over to you in English. So he says that the way that God is going to overthrow these nations is that they themselves are going to be fighting against one another. The whole chariot is going to be overthrown by itself, he says, as they're fighting one against the other, which indeed we do see happening in the world around us today. There's been a constant strife and warfare for hundreds of years, and today we see it all arising again with rising hatred and rising international strife. And I'm going to, since we're reaching the end of today's time frame for this discussion, I'm going to take a break here with Malbim, and we should be coming back to his discussion of those portions of the vision that refer to Melech Moshiach and how the Aramaic text beautifully typifies the coming of Melech Moshiach. And at the end, we shall come to Malbim's very interesting calculations of the season and seasons and the half a season. So this will be in our next session.